2. Robert the manservant waked him late in the morning. He could not elude assistance in getting dressed. He found his way through the huge cold house to the breakfast room. The Baron was already there, and the sisters soon arrived. The two young men were stiff and shy with each other. Itale remarked that it was hot, Enrique that it was damned foggy, and they got no further. Luisa, dressed very plainly in brown, seemed to have set aside her arrogant manner with her evening dress. She was pleasant and gracious, without affectations, and within a few minutes Itale found himself almost at ease talking with her. But she was beautiful, more beautiful than he had realized last night, more beautiful than any woman he had ever spoken to, and he realized as they talked that she was younger than he, 20 at most, which by adding youth to her opulence of beauty, wealth, and wit, cowed him, making him feel a hopeless clod. And the brother glowered across the table. It was a relief when the meal was done at last. Frenin had been living in the city for a month, and had sent Itale his address. Itale asked Enrique where the street was.
"What? Never heard of it," the Baron growled. "Going off, are you? Can't stay? No? Well, glad, very glad."
When Itale had escaped, the Baron followed his sister up to the music room.
"You hear that, Lulu? He's going to some damned street in the river. Somebody's Tears Street. Now what the devil, coming all the way from the damned mountains. I thought he was a gentleman yesterday."
"He is. Don't be stupid, Harry."
"But nobody lives in a place like that."
"Students."
"Students! Exactly."
She knew what was upsetting her brother. Through boredom and a dim sense of shame at his uselessness, Enrique was trying to secure a minor diplomatic post. He had decided that his new acquaintance was politically suspect, therefore not to be cultivated. But he was ashamed of his own motives and preferred to act the snob. All this was clear to Luisa. Her boredom was far more drastic than her brother's, her ambitions clearer, and she set herself up as a conscious enemy of hypocrisy in all its forms.
"You're afraid you've entertained Robespierre unawares," she said. "Poor Harry."
"But you can see that I can't afford to associate with these patriot fellows. I made a mistake, I own up to it. So all I'm asking is that you don't take him up, make a pet of him out of curiosity the way you do."
"Make a pet of him. A bit like making a pet of a cart horse."
"Yes, well, exactly. He's just not quite our sort. It seemed all right on the coach, but he doesn't belong here. So that's all right. We just won't see him again."
"But of course I asked him to dinner tonight."
Enrique breathed heavily, defeated once again.
"He hasn't anywhere to stay, and if he stays here, of course we have to feed him. But I'm sure it will do no harm. No one is coming except Roscainescar."
"Oh, my God!" Enrique cried. You can't have him here with Roscainescar! Luisa!"
But he knew as he spoke that she would do just as she pleased, just as she always did, and that whether he fretted or shouted, it would make no difference at all. Meanwhile, Itale had set off at random into the warm morning. Sunlight breaking through the mist of the river valley gilded the house fronts, the roofs, the double spire of the Cathedral of St. Theodora, only a few streets away. Note: as Le Guin mentions in her introduction to this volume, Theodora was her mother's name. The Byzantine Empress Theodora, circa 500 to 548, an actress who married Emperor Justinian I, is a saint in the Eastern Church, though not in the Roman. End note. He made for the cathedral. It was not as easy to get to as it looked. Though rarely losing sight of the spires, he involved himself in the crisscross of broad, similar avenues of the old quarter, took a wrong turning into Sorden Street, and wandered down it between palaces of the 17th and 16th centuries, rearing their elegant, arrogant facades one against the other. From that sunless, silent grandeur, he emerged into the glare and bustle of the great market. Men bent double, hauling carts, yelled at him to make way. Heavy-shouldered horses pulled their wagons across his path. Women selling leeks and cabbages shouted at him to buy leeks and cabbages. Young women lugging sacks of gleaming vegetables jostled him with the sacks. Old women lunged past him to make a bargain. Fishmongers waved eels in his face, and to avoid the eels he backed into beef carcasses hung round the butcher's stalls amidst shrilling swarms of flies. Portacheca's weekly market would not have filled a corner of it. It went on for blocks, sprawling, displaying, hauling, carrying, bargaining, arguing, selling, buying, stinking, shining, shouting in the young heat of the August sun. And over it all, against the large, quiet morning sky, rose the dun spires of the cathedral. He made it safe to Cathedral Square at last. A few old people sat on benches on the west side under plane trees, thick with summer dust. He stopped in the middle of the square, letting desultory cabs and purposeful walkers pass round him, and gawped at the Cathedral of Krasnoy, the heavy, complex towers, the leap of the spires, the triple portal of carven saints and kings, the great bulk, buoyant and serene as a ship under sail. He stood and looked, and the old men on the benches looked at him. They had seen the cathedral before. At last he went forward and entered the church under the north portal, under St. Roch, auxiliary patron of the city of Krasnoy, smiling in the ogived shadow his stiff, kind, 400-year-old smile. Note. Roch, or Rocco, circa 1295 to circa 1327, was born in Montpellier in the south of France and traveled to Italy, where he tended plague victims. When he contracted the disease himself and fled to the woods to die, tradition says he was tended by a hunting dog, which licked his wounds and fed him until he recovered. After his death, he was canonized and became the patron saint of dogs, as well as the source of miraculous healings from plague. End note. As soon as he came inside the cathedral, he felt himself at home. It was home. His family, his people, had lived there for 8 or 9 centuries. Like the churches of the Montaigne, the cathedral was dark, bare, its high barrel vaults leaving a great deal of room for God. It was as simple and purposeful as a fort. Low Mass was in progress. Lost in the airy darkness of the nave, a few people, faceless, separate, similar, knelt on the bare patterned pavement. Itale joined them. The priest droned, like the old priest of St. Anthony of Malafrena. Credo in unum Deum, and the little old women in black shawls whispered, Omnipotentem. And like an unheeding angel or thunder among mountains, the organ whispered on above them, rehearsing the high mass to be sung on St. Roch's Day. Notes. St. Anthony. Perhaps named for St. Anthony of Padua, 1195 to 1231, a Franciscan friar. Other possibilities include Anthony of Antioch, died 302, Anthony of Egypt, 251 to 356, and Anthony of Kiev, 983 to 1073. Credo in Omnipotentem, Latin, I believe in one God, Almighty. St. Roch's Day. The feast of St. Roch, August 16th, traditionally the day of his death. End of notes. Itale did not stay long. Reassured, yet restless, he went back out into the sun's heat and brightness as the great bell struck 10, vibrating in the stone and in the blood. There was the city, the traffic, the faces of strangers, the streets of stone. He put on his hat and set off striding into River Quarter without the least idea where he was going. Few cities in 1825 had much of a sewer system. This oldest quarter of Krasnoy had none at all, beyond paved or unpaved trenches in the middle of the narrow streets that wound down towards the river. The stench of River Quarter was a mighty presence in itself, more impressive even than the steep darkness of the streets between houses, toppling their upper stories across the way, as if in conspiracy against the sky, and the noise of voices and the constant press and passage of people around the tenements. Out of these choked alleys shot up the fragile towers of old churches. From the noisy crowding at a ragged street market, one came suddenly into a silent square, to a covered fountain brimming with cool water and typhoid fever, and looked up to see, on one hand, the cathedral spires, on the other, the pointed windows of the university on its hill, another world. In such a square, Itale stopped. He was frightened. He was lost, had lost himself in the streets, the crowding houses, the dank archways leading to brawling courtyards, the voices, the smells, the swarms of children, women, men, all nameless, so that he was nameless, knowing none of them, lost. He stood there holding on to his left wrist with his right hand, combating panic. He sat down on the stone seat by the wellhead and gazed persistently at the pavement at his feet. On one stone was a smear and curl of human excrement. He gazed at it, at the stones beneath and around it, square bluish cobbles, grained and glazed with dirt, at the thread of water gleaming in the jointure between two of them. That is all here, he thought. I am here. I cannot be lost. At last he looked up, looking slowly round him, and discovered that he shared the bench with another man. This one wore broken shoes without stockings, and some kind of coat or cape, shapeless and colorless, wrapped carefully around him despite the warmth. He was old, the skull showing in his face. Out of webbed sockets, his eyes stared straight at Itale, a terrible stare, until Itale realized he was blind. "Hello, Grandad," he said huskily. The old man munched and stared. Abruptly he spoke. Itale did not understand the wheezing voice and the strong dialect.
"A long way from home," he seemed to have said.
"That's true. Do you know of a street called Magdalene's Tears, Grandad?"
The old man went on staring, muttering,
Eya.
He stood up, gathering the decrepit coat around him.
"Come on," he said.
"Is it nearby?"
"Malenostrada. How can I tell you? Come on."
Note. Throughout the Orsinian stories, Le Guin gives hints about the Orsinian language, derived from Latin, like Romanian, but similarly influenced by the surrounding Slavic tongues, and its dialects. Lower-class residents of Krasnoy slur the syllables of Magdalene to Malena. End note. Wheezing and muttering, but moving fairly quickly, he set off down an alley, and Itale followed. Children screamed, playing or fighting in a courtyard as they passed. The old man cursed at them and waved his hand, muttering,
Had a stick. Eya.
Evidently he had some sight, for he picked his way without hesitation and kept closer to Itale's side than was agreeable to Itale, for he stank. He talked as they went, and Itale understood about half of it. He had been a tailor till his eyes went bad, and they turned him out of the shop. There was a brother-in-law who had done him wrong, a story about costs rising and shop rents. His voice cracked and grated. He chopped his rigid hands in the air and screamed,
"Dirty Jews! Dirty Jews!"
He felt or saw Itale shearing off from him and hurried his gait pathetically.
"Almost there, young sir, almost there. That big church, that's Sancta Stefan, the basilisk. Now this way, young sir."
They were at the base of the hill of the university. Streets shot up the hill in crazy angles and flights of steps.
Thought I was blind, eh? Thought I was blind, eh?
The hobbling guide stopped.
This is it. Malenastrada. This is it.
The street name Frenin had sent was the Street of the Tears of St. Magdalene. Itale could see no sign or token along the narrow way or at the corner, but he was ready to get free of the old man. He gave him a quarter krune, putting it into the rigid hand. Trying to get it into some pocket or hiding place in his ragged coat, the old man dropped it, and Itale picked it up for him, for he stood blind and groping, unable to bend down to the pavement, and his hand was too arthritic to close on the little coin. Number 9, opposite the pawn shop, Frenin had written. There were no numbers, but there were two pawn shops. He tried across the way from the first one. A fat woman met him in the dark hall, which had a rich, sharp, feral stink of its own. She sent him up the stairs, which were alive with thin, scabby cats, all of them more or less white. He knocked on the door of the first landing, and Frenin opened it. The square, hard face, the familiar voice saying his name, were a tremendous relief and pleasure. They embraced like brothers. "It's good to see you. It's good to see you, Jivan." "Come on in," Frenin began to repress his own pleasure. "Don't let those damn cats in. Why didn't you write you were coming?"
"I came on the same coach the letter would have come on, last night."
"Where are you staying?"
"Fellow I met on the coach, Paludeskar."
"In Rokas Street? The Rutabaga Baron?"
"I don't know."
"Well, you're certainly coming in at the top."
"I don't really know who they are. On the coach,
they're in Brelavi's scandal sheet every issue."
"Brelavi's what?"
Frenin's manner irritated Itale a little. Like everybody here, he seemed to know everything. "He's working for a weekly society tattler, the Krasnoi Skurrility, he calls it. Money, mistress, our Tomas is doing well."
Frenin's tone was unpleasant.
"Big place you have here," Itale said. The room was low but long, and the almost complete lack of furniture made it seem vast.
"Four of these rooms, dirt cheap even for the river. It's too big. I'm getting out end of the month. Try this chair. The back falls off, that one."
"What are you doing?"
"Odd jobs for a Catholic monthly, and reading proof for Rochoy, the publishers. I get by. What are your plans?"
"Find work, first."
"Work? What for?"
It seemed to Itale, perhaps unfairly, that Frenin's question was disingenuous.
"What does one generally work for?"
"Depends who one is."
"I have 22 kruner. That's who I am."
He felt himself to be disingenuous, but it was not easy to talk about not having money. He got up and wandered around the shabby room, looking out the windows.
"Your windows could use a wash." "No help from home, eh?"
"No."
Frenin, the son of a wealthy Solari merchant, was as used to having cash in his pocket as Itale was, but he was also used to talking about money, both the having and the wanting, and that gave him now the advantage he always sought over his friend and seldom gained.
"Your father doesn't approve of your coming here, I take it?"
"Right."
"Is he an Austriani, sir?"
"Not in the least."
"Family quarrel, eh?"
"It's immaterial, Jivan."
22 kruner, eh? About 2 weeks' worth. Well, what can you do?"
"What anybody else can do. How do I know?"
Itale said. His anger satisfied Frenin, who dropped his cool superiority of manner, and said with a grin,
"All right, all right. Are you looking for a place to live, or have you settled down with the Rutabaga Queen?"
"I don't know. My bag's there. I don't want to stay there."
"Why not? It's free."
"I can't."
Itale waved his hands.
footman at breakfast.
How's the young baroness at breakfast?
I don't know. Very polite. It's...
He waved his hands again.
I shouldn't be there.
Frenin grinned again.
Well, come here if you like. It's not Rocus Street, or an estate on Lake Malafrena, but then it only costs 15 kroner a quarter. We can share for a bit.
That is very good of you, Jivan,
Itale said with warmth and gratitude. His deafness to Frenin's jibes exasperated the latter, and at the same time disarmed him. He had never succeeded in establishing between Itale and himself the social barrier that his jealousy asserted to be there. At the same time, a barrier did exist between them, despite all Frenin's efforts to break through it, that of Itale's careless, impervious personal reserve. Itale would not allow him to humiliate either of them. His flashes of anger were not followed by any grudge or punishment. He offered a simple, steady friendship. Frenin wanted more of him, though he did not know what more. What good was friendship? He wanted to get at this defenseless man, understand him, change him, and could not do it. It was perhaps for Itale's sake, to keep in touch with Itale, that Frenin had conceived the plan of coming to Krasnoy.
"We'll settle it with the catwoman. She was downstairs, wasn't she? Mrs. Rosa, she calls herself. Listen, Itale, I've been here 2 months, and nothing has happened. Nothing is happening. There is no radical movement here."
Itale sat down at the table which, with 3 decrepit chairs, constituted the furniture of the room.
"There has to be,"
he said. "I haven't found it."
"But the Café Illyrica?"
"Old men and fifth-rate poets, and Austrian agents."
"There are secret societies."
"There were. They're dead. Years dead. The Friends of the Constitution, yes, that's still going. A lot of retired army men in the East, in the Cesena and Sovena, but not here. Nothing here. Unless you count Amictia."
"Well, then it's up to us. A publication, what we talked about in Solari."
"What's the good? A literary monthly..."
"Who won our bet concerning the power of the written word?"
"Who got put under house arrest?"
"Look here. 1789 didn't rise unpremeditated from the breast of the people. It was the writers..."
Note. 1789. The beginning of the French Revolution. End note.
"All right, but we haven't got any Rousseaus here."
"How do we know? Besides, we do have Rousseau, and Desmoulins, and all the French and English and American writing of the last 100 years to draw on."
Note. Camille Desmoulins, 1760 to 1794, a French journalist and orator who was one of the first to call for the creation of a republic in his radical pamphlet La France Libre, issued after the storming of the Bastille in 1789. He was executed, along with Danton. End note.
"Why else is the government so afraid of print? Listen, I found something Gentz said recently. I've taken it for my guide, my inspiration. He said, as a preventive measure against the abuses of the press, absolutely nothing should be printed for years. With this maxim as a rule, we should soon get back to God and the truth."
Note. Friedrich Gentz. End note.
"God and the truth,"
Frenin repeated softly, in awed disgust. And then they were both silent a minute. The opinion of the chief of the Austrian Imperial Police was undeniably impressive.
"All right," said Frenin. "Assume a journal is the thing. How do we finance it first, and who'll dare print it second?"
"That's what we're here to find out."
"All right. Let's go meet some people."
Itale got back to the Paludeskar house at 6, having spent the afternoon with Frenin at the Café Illyrica, which, despite Frenin's strictures, was still, and would be for 25 years more, a meeting place for radicals of all degrees. There they had met their friend Veyeskar from Solari, a dark young man named Karantai, who wrote stories, a pair of Greek refugees, a ranting alcoholic old poet who talked of his mistress Liberty, a group of students. The talk had been of Greece. As Itale walked up Rokas Street, he was telling himself that if nothing could be done here, he would go to Greece, as Lord Byron had gone, to the plains of Marathon, where they still laid down their lives for freedom. Note: Byron wrote in The Isles of Greece, 1821, "The mountains look on Marathon, and Marathon looks on the sea. And musing there an hour alone, I dreamed that Greece might still be free." An Athenian Plataean army decisively defeated an invading Persian force at Marathon in 490 BCE. End note. He was drunk with Greece, and strong coffee, and strong ideas, and he was not sobered even by entering the large, rich, cold house. He strode up the marble staircase as if he owned the place, and hearing music in the room at the top of the stairs, stopped a moment to listen, as if the music was for him. "Mr. Sordin," said Luisa Paludescar at the piano, another splendid piece of gold and rosewood like the one downstairs, the evening sunlight striking gold through the long windows across her hair, music rippling under her long hands. "Baronina," he said with untroubled resolution, "I must be leaving. May I thank you for your kindness and hope that I will have the privilege of making some return for it?" The formal provincial turns of speech came ready to his tongue, and he never wondered what conceivable return of hospitality he could make from a cat-haunted tenement in the river quarter. He still spoke with his feet planted on the shores of Malafrena. "But you're not leaving, Mr. Sorde. We thought you would make our house yours for a few days at least." She seemed dismayed, disappointed. He grew embarrassed. "It's very good of you, Baronina. An old friend of mine is here. He wants to put me up, but you can't always desert new friends for old ones, and Enrique will be very disappointed." "It's very good of you. We know people, quantities of people. I had thought we really might be of some use to you." "It's very..." He had said it was very good of her twice already. "You're very kind, Baronina, but I..." He did not know what to say. His resolution dissolved like wet sugar. "At least you will dine with us tonight. I do claim that much." "Of course, with great pleasure." Damn the woman. As he went down the hall, the house resounded to the abrupt, brilliant harmonies, played very deftly, of a Mozart presto. Note: a musical passage intended to be played with extreme speed. End note. After her talk of quantities of people, he had expected another large party, and was surprised when he went down to dinner, in his black coat, well brushed by Robert, to find a partie carrée. Himself, Luisa and Enrique Paludescar, and a Count Raskineskar. Note: partie carrée, French, a party of four, literally, a square party. End note. Baroness Paludescar, a lady-in-waiting to the Grand Duchess, was dining at the palace. This dinner was, presumably, in Luisa's style, intimate, elegant. The four French doors of the dining room stood open to the August night. Stars hung thick in the black sky, an intermittent wind moved in the shrubbery of the walled garden, the murmur of a fountain, the stir of leaves, the smell of damp earth and roses, the unease and subtle darkness of a summer night, all entered and mixed strangely with the conversation at the candle-lit table. Luisa, at the head of the table, was so beautiful, so much more beautiful, even than she had appeared last night or in the morning, that Itale was afraid of her. He vaguely felt himself to be in the presence of a dangerous force of nature, a forest fire or a maelstrom. It occurred to him that when poets called a woman a goddess,
sometimes they meant exactly what they said. Enrique wore an anxious, surly look and said very little, and Luisa and Raskineskar ignored him. Raskina was one of the great holdings in Val Altesma, 30 miles southwest from Malafrena. Itale knew the name well. He knew nothing about the landholder, and it was evident that if Raskineskar had ever visited his estate, it had been as no more than a visitor. He was entirely urbane. He was a well-kept man of 40 or so, with long, liver-colored lips, a high forehead, and fine, dark eyes. "So," he said, leaning back a little, when they had come to the sweet wines, "it's quite certain the estates will meet."
"Lot of talk," Enrique growled.
"Not at all, unless you're referring to the meetings themselves, in which case I agree with you. But they will be convened. Cornelius will announce it next month, I fancy, and the great event will come off in the autumn of 27. Ha ha ha! Do you know what the Emperor said about these diets and assemblies? It rather puts them into perspective. He said, 'I have my estates, and if they go too far, I snap my fingers at them and send them home.'"
"Just as Louis the 16th did," said Itale to his plate.
"Oh, come," the Count said, genial. "The Estates General of France are one thing. Our little assembly is quite another. Its convention is merely an act of courtesy on the Emperor's part."
"If the assembly is rude to him, will he snap his fingers?" Luisa asked.
"Yes, of course. That is, Cornelius will do it for him. He needn't be bothered himself."
"Has Cornelius that authority?" asked Itale.
"As the Prime Minister of the head of the state, the Grand Duchess, I should think so. Possibly she'd have to do it herself."
"Under the Charter of 1412, the assembly is subject only to the king. There's nothing that subjects them to the orders of a duchess or her minister."
"Nothing but the Austrian army," Raskineskar said mildly.
"If the Grand Duchess called in the Austrian army to close the National Assembly, that would constitute invasion. We are an ally and protectorate of the Empire. We are not an Austrian province."
"Paper truths, Mr. Sorde. The Austrian army is here, now, controlling our provincial militias. No assembly is going to try to lead us into a revolt, or a war, if you prefer, against the most powerful state in Europe. The idea is laughable."
"That depends on one's sense of humor," Luisa observed.
"True, very true," said Raskineskar, who never contradicted directly, but went at it roundabout. "When the balance of peace is so delicate, when there is the possibility of intervention by one of the great states, Russia, perhaps, it's not so much laughable as terrifying. The war years all over again. One can only respect Metternich for having, in these past 10 years, made such a chance remote, a fantasy, rather than an imminent threat."
Note: Clemens Wenzel von Metternich, the Austrian foreign minister. End note.
"An incredible man, Metternich. He bears the weight of Europe on his shoulders."
"If he put it down, it might turn out to be able to walk by itself," Itale said, with a slight tremor in his voice, but clearly.
Enrique, whose sense of humor was simple, gave a snort of laughter, and then shut his eyes and turned red. "To walk straight into war, I fear," Raskineskar said.
"I'd prefer to walk into war than to be carried into slavery."
"My dear young man," said Raskineskar, who had no desire to quarrel at Luisa Paludeskar's table, "I don't think you know much about war, and I fear slavery has become a fashionable word and so lost its significance. I suppose a black African on a plantation in the Carolinas is a slave, poor brute, but his situation has very little in common with yours or mine." I don't know, Itales said innocently. The American slave can't vote, has no representative in the government, and must get his owner's permission to learn to read or write, or publish or speak in public, doesn't he? If he does any of that without permission, he can be locked up for life without trial. I'm not sure how far our situations differ in those respects. Of course, we are allowed to wear frock coats.
There was only the slightest pause before Count Raskineskar added, "And to read Jean-Jacques Rousseau,
if we can find a clandestine edition."
The Count laughed, indulgently, the laugh of a statesman addressing enthusiastic youth. Enrique shut his eyes again. Luisa laughed very softly, watching Itale. Then she turned to Raskineskar and said, with all the manner of a hostess easing over a difficult moment,
"Which reminds me, Count, I am relying upon you for the Paris journals. You must not let me down."
To which Raskineskar replied courteously as ever with a somewhat pinched smile. He cared nothing at all for Itale's opinions, but he cared a good deal for Luisa's opinion, and he knew now that he had lost a battle that he had not thought worth fighting. The next day, he told a fellow bureaucrat in the Ministry of Finance that the convocation of the estates was not entirely an empty gesture, since certain fashionable salons were openly cultivating patriotic sentiments.
"Silly fads," the colleague said, but Raskineskar, pinching his long lips together significantly, murmured,
"National pride," as if it were the name of a horse he thought of backing.
Itale left the Paludeskars as early as he could decently do so, and found his way past the cathedral, around the hill of the university, behind the Basilica of St. Stephen, through the frightening crowds, and more frightening emptinesses, of the river quarter, to the narrow street where he was to live. He went to bed and lay there on the pallet they had fixed up, his eyes on a crack of light under the door. Frenine was up, writing, in the front room. The night was warm and filled with voices and inexplicable sounds, the swarming city atmosphere. There was no silence. Itale thought of the garden of the Paludeskar house, roses in the dark, the fountain, the golden light on Luisa's throat, and these images changed to yet more tormenting ones. Vivid, unbearable, the roofs of Portaceca, the neat mountain-shadowed yard of Emmanuel's house, the lake, the window of his room above the lake. Never had he felt such anguish of homesickness. And among those glimpses of the lost beloved, there were faces, all the faces he had seen in the streets, the sweating carriers, old women praying, the endless faces of the city, of the poor, and a red-nosed, gray-haired man crying, "My mistress, Liberty!" and the bony, swollen, bare legs of the old blind man who had guided him.